Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Heather McKee Hurwitz, author of Are We the 99%? September 2021 marks the 10th anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, a protest movement against economic inequality that began in New York City's Wall Street Financial District. With the protesters coming from diverse backgrounds, Hurwitz considers how women, people of color, and genderqueer activists struggle to be heard and understood within the movement. Despite the cries of "We are the 99%, problems with racism, sexism, and discrimination due to sexuality and class persisted within the movement. Heather McKee Hurwitz is a lecturer of sociology and feminist scholar at Case Western Reserve University and a visiting researcher at the Cleveland Clinic. Heather McKee Hurwitz, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
So Heather, it's been about 10 years since the Occupy Wall Street movement. And for those who may have vague memories of the movement, why don't you sort of give a summary of that movement and how you got connected with that movement personally?
Absolutely. The movement developed as a response to the Great Recession, which was the stock market crash and the housing bubble that popped in 2008, and there was a growing inequality in the country and really throughout the world. Preceding Occupy, your listeners may recall the Arab Spring and watching protests in Egypt and Tunisia and other places. And in the United States, activists were watching that too. And their response was to develop this movement called Occupy Wall Street in the summer of 2011. And their primary focus was on economic inequality and kind of addressing the Great Recession, addressing evictions, people losing their homes for other reasons, and a huge unemployment at the time. And the movement's key tactic was camping in town squares. And I'm sure in Austin, there was an Occupy Wall Street as well, and probably many other places in Texas. I think Houston had a big encampment, and around the country and the world, more than 1,000 places. The movement brought the idea of "we are the 99%" and really opposing the 1%, those, you know, the mega, mega rich. If only we could pull together as a 99%, we could change some things. So that's kind of the overview of the movement, but it was a lot more complicated than that in the depths of people of a range of different races, ethnicities, genders, sexualities coming together to make this movement happen.
So what was your personal connection to it?
I had been an activist. I'm still an activist. I was an activist for about 20 years. When I saw the movement, I became excited about it because I, too, was concerned about economic inequality. I was beginning my graduate school with an uncertain career ahead. And I was amazed so many people were in the streets and so many different kind of people. Some of the encampments looked really diverse to me, and I wondered how could that be possible? But on the other side of it, I also heard a lot of complaints about even white supremacy, about racism kind of emerging out of these spaces, a lot of white leaders taking charge, and a lot of men also, some violence within the encampments. And I thought, how could this be happening? I want to dig into some of these, especially the racial and gender kind of dimensions of this movement, and understand what was working and understand, where was this movement kind of faltering? Because there was a lot of promise. There was a lot of excitement. People hadn't really been in the streets protesting in this way broadly across the United States, for maybe more than a decade, maybe since the anti-war movement, and maybe even in a bigger way than that time. So I became involved. I started going to I went to the New York encampment. I went to the San Francisco encampment. I met with leaders around the country through a conference, and I was a researcher and an activist. So I was trying to understand the stories of people who maybe weren't really heard on the mainstream news.
To what degree did the white male leadership within the Occupy Wall Street movement recognize their perpetuation of the type of hierarchies that they were actually opposing in Wall Street?
Right. I found that there was really a lot of tension and conflict in the movement around people who have always kind of been these default leaders in mixed race movements, in predominantly African-American movements. We see Black men often being the key leadership. But in this mixed environment, I didn't see white men kind of taking that step back, being listeners, letting other people lead, wanting that diverse leadership. And that became really problematic, especially women of color created separate groups because they felt that their issues, their voices, their leadership, which so many of these women were experienced activists, but they weren't getting the spotlight. They weren't even being really featured on the media. They weren't allowed to take on that leadership position almost, even though this was a movement that was striving to have diverse leadership. That was really a key part of their goal, was to hear from 99% of the people. And the reason why my book is called Are We the 99% is because so many people said to me, you know, it doesn't really feel like we're the 99% within this movement. We don't know how to have diverse leadership, or we're being led by the typical voices, and we somehow need to change up this conversation. So they really questioned that 99% idea.
What lessons did you learn? You have a PhD in sociology, so you study these types of structures, these types of organizations. And I would have to say, when you're bringing together so many people with so many different interests, different backgrounds, different thoughts and ideas about leadership, how do you pull together all these different types of people? I'm part of the NAACP. And even, you know, there's always challenges in pulling people together when you have varied interests. So I'm asking you to put that professor hat on there and researcher hat. What did you learn that you said from watching and studying the Occupy Wall Street movement that you would say, this is what I would share with the activists of today when you're bringing together so many different people?
Yeah. Well, one of the ways that the Occupy movement kind of started on the wrong foot was with their real focus on class without that analysis of how deep the racial dynamics and structures and racism has shaped the kind of inequality in our country. And they also didn't bring in really the complaints of women and of genderqueer people. It was so class focused, kind of with the idea of, you know, let's start with these class issues, and then we'll get to race and we'll get to gender later. And I even had an activist say to me, you know, it's like women of color feminism never happened to these people, and they're ignoring the history of Black feminism for the last 30 years. That was getting off on the wrong foot. That kind of framing that ignores intersectionality, the idea that Kimberly Crenshaw, professor at Columbia, lawyer, came up with that, you know, we really need to think about inequality as the ways that people experience gender, race, class, sexual, age, disability, inequalities all at the same time. The Occupy movement didn't have that. And I think we saw a shift when, for example, Black Lives Matter started about a year after the Occupy movement. And the leaders there really had that intersectional focus from the beginning. The three women who started it were queer Black women, and they were not going to have just a purely economic message. So I think movements will be successful if they have that intersectional perspective and bring in people's real stories of their lives and not just kind of their economic view. I think the other key lesson is that we have learned, it's ingrained in us. A certain person, a certain default kind of leader who a lot of people will gravitate to, who people want to listen to. And we have to kind of break with that. Who do we see on the news, in government? Who are the main leaders? Who are the majority of the leaders in our country? A lot of them are white men. And to break from that, we have to be conscious of that and say, you know, we really need, and this was a tenet within the movement, we need people who are typically seen and heard to step back. And we need to value our people who maybe are not traditionally leaders or seen as leaders, be that queer people, queer Black, Latino, undocumented persons, Indigenous persons. We want them to step up and really hear these voices and have that real conscious objective in mind. We're in any organization that we want to hear from diverse voices. And I'm looking at the name of your show. I think you're part of solving this issue, Hopeton, by bringing, you know, diverse voices so that people can learn to have this. And if we don't have diverse voices, it's just not, there's something off. There's something not right. But I don't think people in the Occupy movement really had that or were conscious of that. And I'll just close by saying, I think that the movements that came after the Occupy movement, especially Black Lives Matter, really drove it home. You know, we're not going to have movements anymore like Occupy that had some faltering around these issues.
The term intersectionality is used quite a bit in a lot of the, you know, the different articles I read. But to break it down, I want to try to sort of simplify it in a manner of speaking, and feel free to correct as I say. When I think of intersectionality, it's almost like that individual is facing oppression from several different perspectives. It's not just one. It's you're poor, you're Black, you're queer. And each of those represent an obstacle that they have to overcome. Did I get that about right?
I agree with you.
Mm-hmm. So when dealing with the white male leadership in Occupy, in the Occupy movement, in your discussions with, because I'm assuming you talked to a lot of people who are part of the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. One, did they understand intersectionality and did they respect it? And were they willing or have they been willing to turn the lens on themselves?
The main people that I met in the movement that were really prioritizing intersectionality and were not generally the white men, it was more the feminist groups and especially the feminists of color and to some degree men and women in some of the spin-off groups like the people of color working group, Occupy the Hood, even the Oakland anti-foreclosure working group. So this tension, this real need for intersectionality was a major discussion within the movement. There was even a conflict within the movement where over the whole name of Occupy, that many Indigenous activists said, we've been spending, 500 years trying to get people not to occupy our land. This is not the best name for us. This name does not speak to the future that we want. We need to change this name. And it also led by activists in Oakland, put forward the name of Decolonize, more bringing in that intersectional perspective of addressing poverty and racial inequality together. So no, I didn't really see the white men that I spoke with, unless they were feminist men, who I did speak to a handful of them. But there were these subgroups that kind of broke off and were almost like a protest group within the movement saying, you got to bring this message, has got to be a decolonized movement. This has to be an intersectional movement. We have to consider undocumented people, Indigenous people at the same time. So it was there, but it didn't get that much news play, but I really think it shaped the movement.
To what degree does the news play affect the perception of movements like Occupy Wall Street? Because just by the mere decision of a reporter to interview the white male, mm-hmm. and if they're constantly interviewing white males as leaders of the Occupy movement, then that presents an image of the Occupy movement.
It definitely did. And I spoke with some feminist activists on the media committee, and they would get these kind of draft press releases from these subgroups with, here's our press release for our event. Here's a quote from someone in our group. And they look at it and say, this really doesn't represent the breadth of people who are participating. We're going to send this back to you. I think you need to kind of bring in more diverse voices here. This isn't the kind of message or conversation that we want to be having. So there was some of that, kind of trying to regulate the messages, but this was just a viral movement that within a couple of weeks really was known nationally. And people who had the most resources, and some of them were the white men, maybe who had, media experience, who had experience on Twitter. It's hard to think back 10 years ago. We weren't savvy Twitter and Facebook organizers at that time. This movement was part of training people to really use Twitter in that moment. And the people who had access, the people who had that kind of education and training, were kind of the loudest voices. And it did really shape the movement. It shaped who became interested. And, it was very frustrating too for activists who were, let's say, doing civil disobedience in foreclosure hearings, and a lot of the houses that were being foreclosed on, a lot of them were older African-American women who were losing their homes, who had these adjustable rate mortgages. And what that message was so important, and it was oftentimes kind of buried. And it's really too bad, because it was one aspect of a very kind of big tent, almost circus-like. There was just so much going on in this movement. And I think those diverse voices were often lost and not amplified in the media as really as much as they should have been.
I want to come back to a point here, because with regards to the foreclosure movement, because communities of color were disproportionately affected by the predatory lending that led to the housing finance industry collapsing. And, you know, I've interviewed several authors about, you know, what happened, and it was pretty clear that the people that were selling the mortgages, their only goal was to sell those mortgages. Had conversations where people admitted that they would get people into mortgages at a higher interest rate than they could actually qualify for, and that they had no consequences because then those mortgages were put into tranches and sold with no consequences to somebody else. And it's one of the interesting things about the mortgage company. I think my mortgage has been sold 8 times. I've lost count of how many times my mortgage has gone from one company to another while, you know, having a servicer. And so, you know, when I look at Occupy Wall Street, to what degree did they address that? Because the you know, we're talking Fannie Mae, we're talking Freddie Mac, we're talking that people of color were underrepresented in home ownership. There were moves and initiatives to increase home ownership among people of color, but then there were also at the same time commercial aspects of it that took advantage of that to promote predatory loans that were not in their best interest. To what degree did Occupy Wall Street and the involvement, especially of the subgroups, address that issue?
Mm-hmm. The places where they did the best job of this were Minnesota, the Occupy Homes group. They were voracious about going after the inequalities that especially African Americans were facing in the mortgage crisis. And also in Oakland, as I mentioned, the anti-foreclosure working group that went door to door asking people what were they enduring and were they under pressure from a bank at the moment? And is there some way that the movement could assist them? Those instances really come to mind. Foreclosure was a key economic issue that activists around the country did address and protest, but other cases, I would say maybe in a little bit more of a general way, because there was so much happening at that moment between unemployment and the stock market plunging and just kind of a general starting recognition of how much power the 1% had and wanting to do things like tax Wall Street and, you know, break up the big banks, stop banks from having this kind of power to kind of run the mortgage industry however they wanted. They were the some aspects of the movement were pressuring for greater regulation of mortgages and loans. So there were a lot of issues, and this is part of why the movement was both exciting and also, you know, it maybe wasn't as successful because it didn't have a centralized leadership saying foreclosure activism should be the cutting edge here. You know, we should prioritize this. It was a very voluntary movement. It was voluntary groups kind of prioritizing whatever issues that they wanted to in the moment. So, you know, on the one hand, they addressed a lot of different issues. On the other hand, could there have been more focus? Maybe if it was organized differently, there would have been.
I think of that time period, and I think of now, I also think of the time period of the robber baron. The early 1900s, J.P. Morgan, all these mergers between, you know, the creation of United Steel, for example, and how there was so much deferral to the captains of the industry. There was a saying, I think it was in the 30s or 40s, what's good for General Motors is good for America. So today, I get a sense that despite everything that happened during that time period, 2008, 2009, 2010, 11, that we don't seem to have made a lot of progress in really curtailing the avariciousness of Wall Street. And I'm going to Glass-Steagall, when they allowed insurance companies and finance companies to come together, and under the leadership of Alan Greenspan, who was a acolyte of Ayn Rand, who was this philosopher who basically, based on her experience growing up in Russia, just said government needs to stay out of as much as possible. And I just think when I look at today, you know, there are so many there's so much power that the wealthy have, the super wealthy, the billionaires, to influence public policy and everything. And it just seems that there's, and labor unions used to provide some level of balance to this power. But it just seems that today, despite all that happened, despite the economy becoming this close to a complete collapse, you know, this close, Lehman Brothers and all the things that happened, that we have not learned, at least in how we'd regulate finance, we have not had a lot of success in making sure we're not vulnerable to too big to fail, because frankly, there's just a lot more regulation that needs to be put in place. What are your thoughts on that?
Unfortunately, I agree with you. We have the idea of the 99% versus the 1%. I think when Bernie Sanders talks about the 1%, who, you know, we have the Bernie Sanders phenomenon, both of his presidential runs, thanks in part to Occupy, because the Occupy movement really popularized this idea of the 99% versus the 1% and a lot of his economic ideas that he's built on. So I think we have an intelligibility around the country in that idea of there's a problem with the 1%, and there is major inequality in our country. I don't think that we talked about economic inequality in the same way before the Occupy movement really brought that framing to the fore. But as far as substantive policy change to regulate micro transactions and the stock market, to regulate the distance between CEO salaries and the general worker's salary. Even we don't have a federal minimum wage, which was a movement, the Fight for 15 was a movement that came on the heels of Occupy Wall Street, really in 2012, pushing for that minimum wage. And we're still fighting for that. So I think you're right that there's still, unfortunately, a really long way to go. And despite the increasing inequality and some other aspects of inequality that have been really laid bare from the pandemic, from food insecurity to the lack of reliable childcare and what that does for the ability of people to maintain work, and the real divide that persists between people who can work remotely and people who don't have that option and are putting their health at risk to keep working, as has happened to the working class throughout our country. There's still just so much work to do to address these economic inequalities.
What advice would you give to the progressive movements of today, understanding that the racial divide has gotten so much worse than it was when the Occupy movement started? And in my reading of history, race has always been used when there was an effort. Well, I won't say always, but often race was used to break up efforts to organize along class issues. So how do you overcome the racial discrimination, the racism that just seems to have been fueled by just purposely demagogic leadership that doesn't really care? I mean, to some degree, maybe, you know, maybe I'm just sort of
making the past look better than it actually was. At least, you know, I'm thinking back to the 80s or the 90s. And while there was class division, there was racism, there was also a lot more crossing of the aisles. It was much more acceptable for Democrats and Republicans to work together. And now it seems that it's a scorched earth policy. And that if you dare, for example, to be a moderate Republican willing to work with Democrats, and they're going to send someone to run against you because they want you to hold the line. What's the advice you give? And once again, I'm asking to put that PhD sociology on the spot. I don't usually get time to write those papers, but I'm really curious because I, you know, working with organizations, we have organizational leaders that listen to this show. So what would be your advice?
Well, that's a tough question, Hopeton. I mean, that is the question.
Yeah.
Right. That is the
question. We got to start somewhere. Someone once told me that, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time.
You know, I think shows like yours and a real conversation about economic inequality and where does it really come from? And who are really the culprits here behind it? I do think the 1% remains a big problem. I think globalization and the shift in production around the world and the shift in our country with automation of so many different jobs and so many people losing their jobs, we don't have a solution to these issues. I don't think that there's good analysis broadly on the Republican side or the Democrat side about the real economic problem at the root. Because I think if we did recognize that, you know, the U.S. Doesn't have the right perspective about not only industry and what we need to develop, but how we need to treat workers, that we need broad healthcare, that we maybe even need a guaranteed basic income. I mean, even just the what happens when people really get a living wage? These questions are unanswered. And without that kind of economic understanding, that no matter if you're a white person living in a rural area or a person of color living in, you know, New York City, you're concerned about those issues, your job security, your health care. And right now, the structure of our country really is not addressing those economic issues. I think that if there was kind of that understanding of, you know, who should really be the target here of what's going on? And how do we really need to kind of radically transform our economy to meet the needs of people more broadly? It's my hope that that can bring disparate people together, because I think people have those basic needs. You know, that said, the racial history and inequality of our country and the deep sexism. And, you know, we're seeing now in Texas the just absolute disregard for the rights of women to control their own bodies. With these kinds of questions up in the air as well, we have a lot of work to do. You know, maybe that economic story behind abortion, about why women need to have that option, need to have control over their bodies, and how that is also a part of our racial history and racial inequality in this country around reproductive justice. And maybe that's some way to come together if people really just keep having these depth conversations. And I don't know the secret to doing that. The Occupy movement, somehow 10 years ago, they broke through with this 99% idea. I think we need a lot more of that on a different level and an intersectional level. And that's my hope, that we can do that.
Heather McKee Hurwitz, author of Are We the 99%, The Occupy Movement, Feminism, and Intersectionality. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you, Hopeton.
Thank you for listening to this podcast edition of Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay. And be sure to rate the podcast 5 stars.